and he had sent them. He thought, a man is asked to bear too much. And he refused. He began slowly to walk forward. He was all done. He would find a gun somewhere and take a walk forward. He walked down the long slope in front of him toward that one battery that was still firing toward the blue line. He saw a rifle by a dead man, a man missing a leg and the leg nearby, bent and chewed at the knee, and the rifle clean and new and cold. He bent down to pick it up. And when he looked up, he saw Lee. The old man was riding the gray horse across the open ground in front of the trees. He had taken his hat off, and the white hair and the unmistakable white head were visible from a long way off. He was walking the horse slowly along the ground among the first rows of dead where the cannon had begun to take them as they stepped out of the trees, and the retreating men were slowed at the sight of him. Longstreet stopped. The old man reined up and stood for a moment immobile, head turned eastward toward the enemy, the gray hat on the horn of the saddle. He sat there motionless as a statue, and the men coming back began to turn toward him. He sat looking down, talking to them. Longstreet stood watching him. He knew that he would never forgive the old man. Never. He stood paralyzed, holding the rifle, and tears were running down his cheeks. The old man saw him and began riding toward him. Longstreet could hear him. It is all my fault. It is all my fault. And men were already arguing with him and shaking their heads in rage and shame. But Lee said, "We shall rest and try it again another day. Now you must show good order. Never let them see you run." There were men all around him, some of them crying. A tall man in a gray beard was pleading with Lee to let them attack again. A bony boy in a ripped and bloody shirt had hold of the halter of his horse and was insisting that the general move to the rear. Lee said again, "It is all my fault." But they were shaking their heads. Lee saw Longstreet. Longstreet waited, the rifle in his hand. Lee rode slowly forward. A crowd of men was gathering now, 100 or more. The stream to the rear had slowed. Now it was quieter, and the nearby cannon were no longer firing, and Lee came forward out of the smoke and the nightmare. His face was hard and red, his eyes bright and hot. He had a stiff, set look to him, and both hands held hard to the saddle horn. And when he looked at Longstreet, his eyes had nothing in them. The old man stopped the horse and pointed east. He said in a soft, feathery voice, "I think they are forming over there, General. I think they may attack." Longstreet nodded. The old man's voice was very soft. Longstreet could hardly hear. Lee looked down on him from a long way away. Longstreet nodded again. There was motion in front of him, and suddenly he saw George Pickett, bloodstained. His hat was gone, his hair streamed like a blasted flower. His face was pale. He moved his head like a man who has heard too loud a sound. He rode slowly forward. Lee turned to meet him. Longstreet was vaguely amazed that Pickett was still alive. He heard Pickett say something to Lee. George turned and pointed back down the hill. His face was oddly wrinkled. Lee raised a hand. "General Pickett, I want you to reform your division in the rear of this hill." Pickett's eyes lighted, as if a sudden pain had shot through him. He started to cry. Lee said again with absolute calm, "General, you must look to your division." Pickett said tearfully, voice of a bewildered, angry boy, "General Lee, I have no division." He pointed back down the hill, jabbing at the blowing smoke, the valley of wrecked men, turned and shuddered, waving, then saying, "Sir, what about my men?" as if even now there was something Lee could do to fix it.
What about my men?
Armstead is gone. Garnet is gone. Kemper is gone. All my colonels are gone. General, everyone. Most of my men are gone. Good God, sir, what about my men? Longstreet turned away. Enough of this. He looked for his horse, beckoned. The groom came up. Longstreet could look down across the way and see blue skirmishers forming across his front. The land sloped to where the one battery was still firing uphill into the smoke. Longstreet nodded. I'm coming. He felt a tug at his leg, looked down. Sorrel.
Let me go, Major.
The staff was around him. Someone had the reins of the horse. Longstreet felt the gathering of a last great rage. He looked down slowly and pulled at the reins slowly and said carefully, Major, you better let this damned horse go. And then he pointed. They're coming, do you see? I'm going to meet them. I want you to put fire down on them and form to hold right here. I'm going down to meet them. He rode off down the hill. He moved very quickly, and the horse spurred, and it was magnificent to feel the clean air blow across your face. And he was aware suddenly of the cold tears blurring his eyes, and tried to wipe them away. Old Hero shying among all the dead bodies. He leaped a fence, and became aware of a horse following, and swung and saw the face of Gory, the frail Texan trailing him like the wind. Ahead of him the guns were firing into a line of blue soldiers, and Longstreet spurred that way, and Gory pulled alongside, screaming, What are your orders, General? Where do you want me to go? A shell blew up in front of him. He swerved to the right. Gory was down, and Longstreet reined up. The bony man was scrambling, trying to get to his feet. Rifle fire was beginning to pluck at the air around them. Longstreet saw some of the staff riding toward him, trying to catch up. He rode to Gory and looked down, but he couldn't say anything more. No words would come. And he couldn't even stop the damn tears. And Gory's eyes looking up, filled with pain and sorrow and pity, was another thing he would remember as long as he lived. And he closed his eyes. The staff was around him, looking at him with wild eyes. Someone again had the bridle of his horse. Bullets still plucked the air. Song of the dark guitar. He wanted to sleep. Someone was yelling, Got to pull back! And he shook his head violently, clearing it, and turned back to the guns, letting the mind begin to function. Place the guns, he bawled. Bring down some guns. He began directing fire. He took another shell burst close by, and again the great drone filled his ears. And after that came a cottony, murmury rush, like a waterfall, and he moved in a black dream, directing the fire, waiting for them to come, trying to see through the smoke where the shells were falling. But the firing began to stop. The storm was ending. He looked out through the smoke and saw no more blue troops. They had pulled back. He thought, to God, If there is any mercy in you at all, you will finish it now. But the blue troops pulled back, and there was no attack. After a while, Longstreet sat on a fence. He noticed the rifle still in his hand. He had never used it. Carefully, gently, he placed it on the ground. He stared at it for a while. Then he began to feel nothing at all. He saw the dirt-streaked face of T.J. Gory watching him.
How are you? Longstreet said.
Tolerable.
Longstreet pointed uphill.
They aren't coming.
Gory shook his head.
Too bad, Longstreet said.
Yes, sir.
Too bad.
Longstreet said again.
Yes, sir. We got plenty of canister left. If they hit us now, we could sure make it hot for them.
Longstreet nodded. After a moment, Gory said,
General, I tell you plain. There are times when you worry me.
Well, Longstreet said,
it's no good trying to get yourself killed, General. The Lord will come for you in his own time.
Longstreet leaned back against a fence post and stared up into the sky. For a moment he saw nothing but the clean and wondrous sky. He sat for a moment, coming back to himself. He thought of Lee as he had looked riding that hill, his hat off so that the retreating men could see him and recognize him. When they saw him, they actually stopped running. From death itself. It was darker now. Late afternoon. If Meade was coming, he would have to come soon. But there was no sign of it. A few guns were still firing a long way off. Heartbroken men would not let it end. But the fire was dying. The guns ended like sparks. Suddenly it was still. Enormously still. A long pause in the air. A waiting. A fall. And then there was a different silence. Men began to turn to look out across the smoldering field. The wind had died. There was no motion anywhere but the slow smoke drifting, and far off one tiny flame of a burning tree. The men stood immobile across the field. The knowledge began to pass among them, passing without words, that it was over. The sun was already beginning to set beyond new black clouds which were rising in the west, and men came out into the open to watch the last sunlight flame across the fields. The sun died gold and red, and the final light across the smoke was red. And then the slow darkness came out of the trees and flowed up the field to the stone wall, moving along above the dead and the dying like the shadowing wing of an enormous bird. But still far off beyond the cemetery, there was golden light in the trees on the hill, a golden glow over the rocks and the men in the last high places. And then it was done, and the field was gray. Longstreet sat looking out across the ground to the green rise of the Union line, and he saw a blue officer come riding along the crest, surrounded by flags and a cloud of men, and he saw troops rising to greet him. "They're cheering," Gorey said bitterly. But Longstreet could not hear. He saw a man raise a captured battle flag, blue flag of Virginia, and he turned from the sight. He was done. Sorrel was by his side, asking for orders. Longstreet shook his head. He would go somewhere now and sleep. He thought, couldn't even quit. Even that is not to be allowed. He mounted the black horse and rode back toward the camp and the evening. With the evening came a new stillness. There were no guns, no music. Men sat alone under ripped, branchless trees. A great black wall of cloud was gathering in the west, and as the evening advanced and the sky grew darker, they could begin to see the lightning, although they could not yet hear the thunder. Longstreet functioned mechanically, placing his troops in a defensive line. Then he sat alone by the fire drinking coffee. Sorrel brought the first figures from Pickett's command. Armstead and Garnett were dead. Kemper was dying. Of the 13 colonels in Pickett's division, 7 were dead and 6 were wounded. Longstreet did not look at the rest. He held up a hand, and Sorrel went away. But the facts stayed with him. The facts rose up like shattered fence posts in the mist. The army would not recover from this day. He was a professional, and he knew that as a good doctor knows it, bending down for perhaps the last time over a doomed, beloved patient. Longstreet did not know what he would do now. He looked out at the burial parties and the lights beginning to come on across the field like clusters of carrion fireflies. All that was left now was more dying. It was final defeat. They had all died, and it had accomplished nothing. The wall was unbroken, the Blue Lion was sound. He shook his head suddenly, violently, and remembered the old man again, coming bareheaded along the hill, stemming the retreat. After a while, Lee came. Longstreet did not want to see him. But the old man came, and a cluster of men outlined under that dark and ominous sky, the lightning blazing beyond his head. Men were again holding the bridle of the horse, talking to him, pleading. There was something oddly biblical about it. And yet even here in the dusk of defeat there was something else in the air around him. The man brought strength with his presence. Doomed and defeated, he brought nonetheless a certain majesty. And Longstreet, knowing that he would never quite forgive him, stood to meet him. Lee dismounted. Longstreet looked once into his face, and then dropped his eyes. The face was set and cold, stone-like. Men were speaking. Lee said, "I would like a few moments alone with General Longstreet." The men withdrew. Lee sat in a camp chair near the fire, and Longstreet sat, and they were alone together. Lee did not speak. Longstreet sat staring at the ground, into the firelight. Lightning flared. A cool wind was blowing. After a while, Lee said, "We will withdraw tonight." His voice was husky and raw, as if he had been shouting. Longstreet did not answer. Lee said, "We can withdraw under cover of the weather. If we can reach the river, there will be no more danger." Longstreet sat waiting, his mind vacant and cold. Gradually he realized that the old man was expecting advice, an opinion, but he said nothing. Then he looked up. The old man had his hand over his eyes. He looked vaguely different. Longstreet felt a chill. The old man said slowly, "Peter, I'm going to need your help." He kept his hand over his eyes, shading himself as if from bright sunlight. Longstreet saw him take a deep breath and let it go. Then he realized that Lee had called him by his nickname. Lee said, "I'm really very tired." Longstreet said quickly, "What can I do?" Lee shook his head. Longstreet had never seen the old man lose control. He had not lost it now, but he sat there with his hand over his eyes, and Longstreet felt shut away from his mind, and in that same moment felt a shudder of enormous pity. He said, "General." Lee nodded. He dropped the hand and glanced up once quickly at Longstreet, eyes bright and black and burning. He shook his head again. He raised both palms, a gesture almost of surrender, palms facing Longstreet, tried to say something, shook his head for the last time. Longstreet said, "I will take care of it, General. We'll pull out tonight." "I thought," Lee said huskily. Longstreet said, "Never mind." "Well," Lee said. He took a long, deep breath, faced the firelight. "Well, now we must withdraw." "Yes." They sat for a while in silence. Lee recovered. He crossed his legs and sat looking into the fire, and the strength came back. The face smoothed calm again and grave, the eyes silent and dark. He said, "We must look to our own deportment. The spirit of the army is still very good." Longstreet nodded. "We will do better another time." Longstreet shook his head instinctively. He said, "I don't think so." Lee looked up. The eyes were clearer now. The moment of weakness had come and passed. What was left was a permanent weariness. A voice in Longstreet said, "Let the old man alone." But there had been too much death. It was time for reality. He said slowly, "I don't think we can win it now." After a moment, Lee nodded, as if it were not really important. He said, "Perhaps."
"I don't think," Longstreet raised his hands. "I don't know if I can go on leading them to die for nothing."
Lee nodded. He sat for a long while with his hands folded in his lap, staring at the fire, and the firelight on his face was soft and warm. Then he said slowly, "They do not die for us, not for us. That, at least, is a blessing." He spoke, staring at the fire. "Each man has his own reason to die. But if they go on, I will go on." He paused. "It is only another defeat." He looked up at Longstreet, lifted his hands, palms out, folded them softly, slowly. "If the war goes on, and it will, it will. What else can we do but go on? It is the same question forever. What else can we do? If they fight, we will fight with them. And does it matter after all who wins? Was that ever really the question? Will God ask that question in the end?" He put his hands on his thighs, started painfully to rise. He got to his feet, laboring. Longstreet reached forward instinctively to help him. Lee said, embarrassed, "Thank you." And then, where Longstreet held his arm, he reached up and covered Longstreet's hand. He looked into Longstreet's eyes. Then he said, "You were right, and I was wrong. And now you must help me see what must be done. Help us to see. I've become very tired."
"Yes," Longstreet said.
They stood a moment longer in the growing dark. The first wind of the coming storm had begun to break over the hills and the trees, cold and heavy and smelling of rain. Lee said,
"I lectured you yesterday on war."
Longstreet nodded. His mind was too full to think.
"I was trying to warn you, but you have no cause. You and I, we have no cause. We have only the army. But if a soldier fights only for soldiers, he cannot ever win. It is only the soldiers who die."
Lee mounted the gray horse. Longstreet watched the old man clear his face and stiffen his back and place the hat carefully, formally on his head. Then he rode off into the dark. Longstreet stood watching him out of sight. Then he turned and went out into the field to say goodbye. And when that was done, he gave the order to retreat. 6. Chamberlain. In the evening he left the regiment and went off by himself to be alone while the night came over the field. He moved out across the blasted stone wall and down the long, littered slope, until he found a bare rock where he could sit and look out across the battlefield at dusk. It was like the gray floor of hell. Parties moved with yellow lights through blowing smoke under a low gray sky, moving from black lump to black lump, while papers fluttered and blew and fragments of cloth and cartridge and canteen tumbled and floated across the gray and steaming ground. He remembered with awe the clean green fields of morning, the splendid yellow wheat. This was another world. His own mind was blasted and clean, windblown. He was still slightly in shock from the bombardment, and he sat not thinking of anything but watching the last light of the enormous day, treasuring the last gray moment. He knew he had been present at one of the great moments in history. He had seen them come out of the trees and begin the march up the slope, and when he closed his eyes he could still see them coming. It was a sight few men were privileged to see. and many who had seen it best had not lived through it. He knew that he would carry it with him as long as he lived. And he could see himself as an old man trying to describe it to his grandchildren, the way the men had looked as they came out into the open and formed for the assault, the way they stood there shining and immobile, all the flags high and tilting and glittering in the sun. And then the way they all kicked to motion, suddenly, all beginning to move at once, too far away for the separate feet to be visible, so that there seemed to be a silvery rippling all down the line. And that was the moment when he first felt the real fear of them coming, when he saw them begin to move. Chamberlain closed his eyes and saw it again. It was the most beautiful thing he had ever seen. No book or music would have that beauty. He did not understand it. A mile of men flowing slowly, steadily, inevitably up the long green ground, dying all the while, coming to kill you. And the shell bursts appearing above them like instant white flowers, and the flags all tipping and fluttering. And dimly you could hear the music and the drums, and then you could hear the officers screaming. And yet even above your own fear came the sensation of unspeakable beauty. He shook his head, opened his eyes. Professor's mind. But he thought of Aristotle. Pity and terror. So this is tragedy. Yes, he nodded. In the presence of real tragedy, you feel neither pain nor joy nor hatred, only a sense of enormous space and time suspended. The great doors open to black eternity, the rising across the terrible field of that last, enormous, unanswerable question. It was dark around him. There was one small, gray area of the sky still aglow in the west. The rest was blackness and flashes of lightning. At that moment a fine rain began to fall, and he heard it come toward him, seeking him in a light patter up the slope. He had dust all over him, a fine pulverized powder from the shelling, dust in his hair and eyes, and dust gritty in his teeth. And now he lifted his face to the rain and licked his lips, and could taste the dirt on his face, and knew that he would remember that too, the last moment at Gettysburg. A taste of raw earth in the cold and blowing dark, the touch of cold rain, the blaze of lightning. After a while, Brother Tom found him, sitting in the rain, and sat with him and shared the darkness and the rain. Chamberlain remembered using the boy to plug a hole in the line, stopping the hole with his own brother's body like a warm, bloody cork, and Chamberlain looked at himself. It was so natural and clear, the right thing to do. Fill the gap with the body of my brother. Therefore Tom would have to go. And Chamberlain told himself, run the boy away from you, because if he stays with you, he'll die. He stared at the boy in the darkness. Felt an incredible love. Reached out to touch him. Stopped himself. Tom was saying, I guess you gotta hand it to them, the way they came up that hill. Chamberlain nodded. He was beginning to feel very strange, stuffed and strange. But we stood up to them. They couldn't break us, Tom said. No. Well, nobody ever said they wasn't good soldiers. Well, they're Americans anyway, even if they are Rebs. Yes, Chamberlain said. Thing I cannot understand. Thing I never will understand. How can they fight so hard, them Johnnies, and all for slavery? Chamberlain raised his head. He had forgotten the cause. When the guns began firing, he had forgotten it completely. It seemed very strange now to think of morality, or that minister long ago, or the poor runaway black. He looked out across the dark field, could see nothing but the yellow lights and outlines of the black bodies stark in the lightning. Tom said, when you ask them prisoners, they never talk about slavery. But Lawrence, how do you explain that? What else is the war about? Chamberlain shook his head. If it weren't for the slaves, there'd never have been no war, now would there?
No, Chamberlain said.
Well then, I don't care how much political fast talking you hear. That's what it's all about, and that's what them fellas died for. And I tell you, Lawrence, I don't understand it at all.
No, Chamberlain said. He was thinking of Kilrain. No divine spark. Animal meat. The killer angels.
Out in the field nearby, they were laying out bodies, row after row, the feet all even and the toes pointing upward like rows of black leaves on the border of a garden. He saw again the bitter face of Kilrain, but Chamberlain did not hate the gentlemen, could not think of them as gentlemen. He felt instead an extraordinary admiration. It was as if they were his own men who had come up the hill, and he had been with them as they came, and he had made it across the stone wall to victory, but they had died. He felt a violent pity. He said slowly, in memory of Kilrain, "Well, they're all equal now. In the sight of God, anyways."
"Yes," Chamberlain said, "in the sight of God."
Tom stood up. "Better get moving, Lawrence. There's a big rain coming." Chamberlain rose, but he was not yet ready to go. Tom said, "Do you think they'll attack again?"
Chamberlain nodded. They were not yet done. He felt an appalling thrill. They would fight again. And when they came, he would be behind another stone wall waiting for them. And he would stay there until he died or until it ended, and he was looking forward to it with an incredible eagerness, as you wait for the great music to begin again after the silence. He shook his head, amazed at himself. He thought, "Have to come back to this place when the war is over. Maybe then I'll understand it." The rain was much heavier now. He put on the stolen cavalry hat and blinked upward into the black sky. He thought, "It was my privilege to be here today." He thanked God for the honor. Then he went back to his men. The light rain went on falling on the hills above Gettysburg, but it was only the overture to the great storm to come. Out of the black night it came at last, cold and wild and flooded with lightning. The true rain came in a monster wind, and the storm broke in blackness over the hills and the bloody valley. The sky opened along the ridge, and the vast water thundered down, drowning the fires, flooding the red creeks, washing the rocks and the grass and the white bones of the dead, cleansing the earth, and soaking it thick and rich with water, and wet again with clean, cold rainwater, driving the blood deep into the earth, to grow again with the roots toward heaven. It rained all that night. The next day was Saturday, the 4th of July. Thus ended the great American Civil War, which must upon the whole be considered the noblest and least avoidable of all the great mass conflicts, of which till then there was record. Winston Churchill, A History of the English-Speaking Peoples. Afterward. Robert Edward Lee. In August he asked to be relieved of command. Of the battle, he says, "No blame can be attached to the army for its failure to accomplish what was projected by me. I alone am to blame, in perhaps expecting too much of its prowess and valor. Could I have foreseen that the attack on the last day would fail, I should certainly have tried some other course. But I do not know what better course I could have pursued." His request is not accepted, although he cites his poor health, and he serves until the end of the war. He never again attempts a Napoleonic assault. When the war is over, he believes that the issue has been settled by combat, that God has passed judgment.
He lays down arms, asks his men to do the same. His great prestige brings a peace which might not otherwise have been possible. He asks Congress for pardon. It is never given. Dies of heart disease in 1870, perhaps the most beloved general in the history of American war. James Longstreet. That winter he requests relief from command, on the ground that he no longer believes the South can win the war. Lee prevails upon him to stay. He is wounded severely in the Wilderness, 1864, but returns to be Lee's most dependable soldier, his right hand until the end at Appomattox. After the war, he makes two great mistakes. First, he becomes a Republican, attempts to join with old comrade Grant in rebuilding the South. For this, he is branded a turncoat. Within 2 years of the end of the war, is being referred to by Southern newspapers as the most hated man in the South. Second, as time passes and it becomes slowly apparent that the war was lost at Gettysburg, Longstreet gives as his opinion what he believes to be true, that the battle was lost by Robert E. Lee. This occurs long after Lee's death, when Lee has become the symbol of all that is fine and noble in the Southern cause. The South does not forgive Longstreet the insult to Lee's name. At the great reunion years later of the Army of Northern Virginia, Longstreet is not even invited. But he comes anyway, stubborn to the end, walks down the aisle in his old gray uniform, stars of a general on his collar, and is received by an enormous ovation by the men, with tears and an embrace from Jefferson Davis. His theories on defensive warfare are generations ahead of his time. The generals of Europe are still ordering massed assaults against fortified positions long years after his death, in 1904, at the age of 83. Richard Ewell serves with courage until the end, but as a corps commander he is fated never to achieve distinction. Of the Battle of Gettysburg he is later to remark, "It took a great many mistakes to lose that battle, and I myself made most of them." Ambrose Powell Hill. Never to take his place in the Richmond society he so dearly loved, so richly deserved. 5 days before Appomattox, at the Battle of Five Forks, he is killed by a sniper's bullet. John Bell Hood loses not the arm, but the use of it. It remains withered within his pinned sleeve for the rest of his days. Complains bitterly about the handling of the army at Gettysburg. Is later given a command of his own, the Army of Tennessee. Defeated in Atlanta by Sherman, he spends much of the rest of his life justifying his actions in the field. Dorsey Pender. His wound grows steadily worse. An operation is performed within the month at Staunton, but he begins to hemorrhage. The leg is amputated. He dies within the month. His wife attributes his death to the judgment of God. Isaac Trimble. Wounded, is left behind to be captured by the enemy. Loses his leg. Survives the war. Of the charge at Gettysburg, he says, "If the men I had the honor to command that day could not take that position, all hell couldn't take it." Johnston Pettigrew. Survives the charge at Gettysburg with only a minor wound in the hand. Is shot to death 10 days later in a delaying action, guarding the retreat across the Potomac. George Pickett. His division is virtually destroyed. No field officer is unhurt. Of the 13 colonels in his command that day, 7 are dead, 6 are wounded. His casualties exceed 60%. The famous charge of the Light Brigade, in comparison, suffered casualties of approximately 40%. Pickett survives to great glory, but he broods on the loss. When the war is over, he happens one day on John Singleton Mosby, on the way to see Robert Lee, and together they visit the old man. The meeting is, in Mosby's words, singularly cold. After it is over, Pickett comes outside and says bitterly, "That man destroyed my division." Jubal Early serves until near the end of the war, when Lee finds it necessary to relieve him because of complaints against him by citizens he has offended. His conduct after the war is notable for two episodes. He becomes the Southern officer most involved in trying to prove that Longstreet was responsible for the loss at Gettysburg. And he becomes the central figure in the infamous Louisiana lottery, which cost thousands of Southerners thousands of dollars. Arthur Freemantle returns to England after 3 months in the Confederacy and writes a book on his experience, which is published in the South 3 months before the end of the war. It is a very readable and entertaining book, which predicts a certain Southern victory. Harrison. He vanishes from Longstreet's records. Years after the war, Moxley Sorrell attends a play, notices something vaguely familiar about one of the actors, recognizes Harrison. He goes backstage for a moment, they speak for a moment, but Sorrell is a gentleman and Harrison is a player, and there is no further connection. Nothing else of Harrison is known. John Buford. Never to receive recognition for his part in choosing the ground and holding it, and in so doing saving not only the battle but perhaps the war, he survives the summer, but is weakened by wounds. In December of that year he goes down with pneumonia and dies of it. Winfield Scott Hancock survives the wound at Gettysburg. When the war ends, it is found that his Second Corps captured more prisoners, more colors, and suffered more casualties than the entire rest of the Army of the Potomac. An enormously popular man all his life, in 1880 he runs for the presidency on the Democratic ticket, against Garfield. But the country has had 2 terms of Grant and is weary of generals in high office, and so he is defeated, retires from public life. The package Lew Armstead sent Elmira Hancock was Armstead's personal Bible. Joshua Lawrence Chamberlain. In August, he is given a brigade. Shortly thereafter, he is so badly wounded, shot through both hips, that he is not expected to live. But he returns to become one of the most remarkable soldiers in American history. Wounded 6 times, cited for bravery in action 4 times, promoted to Brigadier General by special order of Ulysses Grant for heroism at Petersburg, breveted Major General for heroism at Five Forks. He is the officer chosen by Grant from all other Northern officers to have the honor of receiving the Southern surrender at Appomattox, where he startles the world by calling his own troops to attention to salute the defeated South. He is given 1st place in the last Grand Review in Washington. For his day at Little Round Top, he is to receive the Congressional Medal of Honor. In Maine, he is elected governor by the largest majority in the history of the state and returned to office 3 times, where he alienates political friends by refusing to agree to the impeachment of Andrew Johnson. In 1876, elected president of Bowdoin University, where he attempts to modernize the school, introducing courses in science, de-emphasizing religion, and becomes involved in student demonstrations over the question of ROTC. Receives Medal of Honor from France for distinguished efforts in international education. When he retires from Bowdoin, he has taught every subject in the curriculum except mathematics. Dies of his wounds, June 1914, at the age of 83.
We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of The Killer Angels by Michael Shera. This program was produced by Dan Musselman and directed by Gabrielle DeCure, executive producer Sherry Huber. Text copyright 1974 by Michael Shera. Copyright renewed 2002 by Jeffrey M. Shera and Lila E. Shera. Introduction copyright 2004 by Jeffrey M. Shera. Production copyright 2004, Random House, Inc., all rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.